Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisory firm. Price Financial Group has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investment and retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations may vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial program with a certified financial planner, estate planning attorney, and a certified public accountant to answer your questions for free. Got a tough estate, tax, or financial problem keeping you up at night? You can call the show right now at 503-222-9700. That's 503-222-9700. Long distance and podcast listeners can call toll free at 800-344-5836. Coming to you live from Portland, Oregon, and broadcast on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
We do Investing Simplified.
Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're joining us, thank you for making us a part of your day. As a reminder, we do post replays of the show. If you can't catch us live here on the radio, we post it to our website, pfgwm.com. You can also get it at investingsimplifiedradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's radio.com, Apple Music, Google Play, and the like. So if that's something that you're interested in, please download it, subscribe to it, give us a review there. It helps us make sure that we're getting the content out to you. And as a reminder, we are still not able to take your phone calls live in the air, unfortunately. We're not set up for that just yet. But if you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, remember, there is no stupid question when it comes to your money. Send it to askbo@pfgwm.com or leave it at investingsimplifiedradio.com. With me in studio again is Matt May, Chief Investment Officer at Price Financial Group. How's it going, Matt?
Doing very well, Bo. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for being here, you know, partner. Thanks for joining me. I know we've gotten some good feedback from people listening. If you have a question, this is new, at least new in the last few weeks. If you have specific, you know, investment type questions, we can't give investment advice, but Matt can tell you what he's seeing in the markets, what he's, you know, seeing out there, and, you know, what our understandings are. You can leave those questions in those various spaces. We do have Taylor Cattell with KG Law Group, who's going to be coming in studio later on today, so stay tuned for that. But Matt, we've had just a crazy week in the market since we were last on, or going into when we were on last week, and now, you know, through this week, it's been quite the roller coaster. You know, when we talk about, you know, swings in the market from stock splits, you know, people are talking out there, we've got these big companies that are splitting their stock, to should we be riding that roller coaster? What are some things that you're hearing from clients?
There has been a lot of chatter about the stock splits. And, you know, to me personally, it seems to be one of the, I don't want to say gimmick, it feels like one of the biggest gimmicks in the investment world, but certainly maybe an implication that when a stock splits, it will just automatically go back up to its pre-split price.
Sure.
So I wanted to chat about that. So
yeah,
there have been a couple of big companies in the news with their stock splits, Tesla and the beloved Apple.
Yeah, yeah.
Tesla had a rough day today or yesterday. It was definitely beaten up pretty badly. So when we're looking at stock splits, one thing to know as an investor, mathematically speaking, a stock split doesn't do anything for you. It doesn't give you any mathematical benefit whatsoever.
Right.
So looking at Apple, we did a 4-for-1 split. So every one share of Apple became 4 shares of Apple worth 1/4 of the price. So it's like taking a dollar and saying, I'm going to split that $1 into 4 quarters. Great. You can get a quarter for only 25 cents. But that 25 cents only buys you 1/4 of what it used to.
Right. It's the same, right? So that, I like that analogy a lot, that taking 4 quarters, or taking a dollar and turning it into 4 quarters, because people think about, well, the stock is splitting, so now I have 4 shares. Yeah, you have 4 quarters.
it's,
but it's
the
still worth a dollar.
It's right? That implication that that 25 cents is going to grow to the dollar again. And that happens.
Sometimes.
Historically, Intel did that many times, several sure. times. It got up to roughly about 76-ish dollars a share usually, and then it would split 2-for-1 usually. And it's the implication that it's just going right. to keep on going up and then split, keep on going up and then split. Because Apple had done a 7-for-1 share split when it got up to $700 years ago.
Right.
And now the 4-for-1 split recently, it's the implication that it'll keep on going higher. But eventually, sometimes, that the split stop. Intel hasn't split in quite some time.
Right.
But Apple, it is curious about the math. Because now you have four times as many shares, and each share is worth one quarter as much. Because when you own shares of a company, you are a part owner in the company.
Right.
So it mathematically doesn't change anything. You had one share that was worth one particular slice of the pie.
Right, one percentage of whatever that percentage is worth, right?
Right, and now you have four smaller pieces that add up to that one amount, one slice of the pie that you had before.
Right.
So mathematically, it doesn't do anything. It's just the perception that that share price is going to climb back to its previous high. So it's usually better to own the company pre-split if you're looking to for a short-term trade. To there is a lot of hype in talking about a company pre-split, and then usually after the split, more often than not, relatively quickly after the split, there is some sort of pullback normally.
When we saw that a few weeks ago with Tesla's split and with Apple split, when they did it, right? It's running up to it in the months leading up to it, right? I mean, Tesla went crazy, right? It was
bananas.
Banana, just crazy.
That thing had a PE ratio of over 1,000.
So for folks that don't know what the PE ratio, that's a ratio of the price relative to the earnings of the company. So basically for every share, you're paying 1,000 times their earning, right? You were saying it was over 1,000. When we talk about the S&P 500, you know, the market being overpriced, we're talking in the 25-26 PE ratio, right? That's overpriced. This was 1,000.
Over 1,000, yeah.
To give you an idea of how, historically speaking, using the PE ratio, how overpriced it could have been just because of this massive run-up. And, you know, is there something in your experience, Matt, to the idea that not just is it going to get back to the price it was before, but, you know, a lot of people would say, well, I can't own Tesla. It's $2,000 a share, but I could own it now that it's only cost me $400 a share, right?
That is the other perceived implication is that, oh, it's cheaper now.
Right, right.
Again, going back to that $1 that split into four quarters. Yeah, it's only a quarter now, but it's only worth a quarter as much.
$1. Well, that's a thing I think people get hung up on a lot. And I know we have that conversation often with clients where they say, well, why would I buy one share of Amazon? It's, you know, whatever it is, $4,000 a share or whatever, right? Why would I buy that when I could buy, you know, 500 shares of this penny stock? And they don't think about the fact that a 10% return on your one share is the same as a 10% return on your 500 shares if they're worth the same amount of money.
Yeah, that reminds me of a story. This is probably definitely within the first 2 years, perhaps within the first 1 year that I was an advisor. This is 2010. I had a client walk through the door in 1989. He had bought one share of Berkshire Hathaway A shares.
Sure.
And the share price was something like $9,800 a share. And he bought a $10,000 tax-free muni bond. And the tax-free muni bond paid him something like 5.5% tax-free every single year. And at the time that he had come in to take that one share of Berkshire Hathaway A shares into me to cash it in, because right. it was for his son's college,
yeah.
that nearly $10,000 investment was now $111,000. So Berkshire Hathaway, they're one of those companies that just won't... it's owned by Warren Buffett, who right. is... of course, the Oracle of Omaha.
The legendary value investor. Yeah, yeah.
Loves dividend-paying companies. His own company doesn't pay a dividend. Loves, you know, he loves Apple. You know, he's one of the big shareholders. Apple had a big split. Berkshire Hathaway, never going to split that share. I was just curious. I wanted to, you know, as we're chatting here, I wanted to kind of find out how much Berkshire Hathaway A-class shares are going for.
So but, yeah, so that yeah, it, which is, you know, the key to remember is, you know, wherever whenever you may be listening to this, this is maybe a different price than what than what we're going to tell you it is right now. But
right, yeah, $327,200 is where
for
that,
one share. That's crazy. See, now that's a situation where I could see people saying, well, I don't have $327,000
now. Now, in looking at that, back in 1989, when the gentleman bought one share of Berkshire Hathaway, is $9,800 expensive for that one share? No, because, you know, by 2010, it turned into $111,000. Awesome. Now that $111,000 in 2010 turned into $327,000 in 2020.
Which could, so
is that stock expensive? It looks nowhere. It's nowhere near as expensive as what Apple is on a technical basis.
On a price to earnings basis, or when you're doing that analysis on those stocks, right? Which is key. So if you're thinking about exploring, you know, what stocks might be right for you, and you want to have Matt take a look and, you know, have him run that through our screens and run that through our team to see if you're portfolio is built, is weather, you know, ready to weather the storm, whether the individual stocks that you have in there, what his thoughts are on them. We can't give that to you over the radio, but you can give us a call at 503-253-3000. Set up an appointment with Matt. He'll tell you what he thinks about your portfolio, where you're at, you know, thoughts on it. If it looks great, there's no obligation. As always, when you meet with members of our team, there is no obligation and there's no cost for that review. So we're going to take a break, Matt. I know we want to talk about some, you know, different ideas on investing, some, you know, strategies that we use. We also want to bring in Taylor here. I think we're going to do her. She's going to be coming in next segment to cover some questions that we've had from listeners. But if you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at askbo@pfgwm.com. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thank you for joining us. If you're just now coming in, joining us here in studio, Matt, it's very exciting. This is your first experience with Taylor on the phone, on the radio show.
Live in person. She's right here with us.
Right here with us for Cover Your Assets. That, you know, that is what we call her segment. It makes me very happy every time.
An appropriate title.
So, Taylor, I know you and Matt were discussing in the break. We had a question, Matt. You know, what was your question? Kind of something that comes up and a question that gets asked of attorneys all the time, right?
I had a really interesting case this week, and I know that this one is a little bit more involved. I guess it's kind of two part, Taylor. So, I had a client who inherited money. And it was an odd way that it processed. The original owner, it was a qualified account. Mm-hmm. This one was a SEP IRA. Mm-hmm. And they passed away. And before the funds inside it were distributed to the named beneficiary, the beneficiary passed away.
Yikes.
And so in that instance, those funds would be sent to an estate account. What actually happens in that process? Can you explain to me now that those... The folks that were named in that estate as the in the will, mm-hmm, to receive assets, how do they go about processing or administering the estate?
That's a great question. So there's a couple ways to unpack that and a couple consequences that are important to consider. The first is just who gets it. right? Where does it go? How does it get distributed from there when the beneficiary dies? And this comes up in a couple different ways, depending on whether the beneficiary dies before the owner or after the owner, because that could make a difference too. And then there's the practical answer in addition to the legal answer. So the practical answer is whatever the financial institution will let you do that's going to be the most convenient and least expensive. There's some gray area to try to wiggle your way out to the right way where you can avoid some of the tax hit. But there, the legal answer is really quite black and white. If the owner died and there's a beneficiary named, it's the beneficiaries. And if the beneficiary unfortunately dies before it is distributed, it's their money, which means it goes through their estate.
Okay.
The estate process is typically a probate process in that case, because they wouldn't have had the opportunity to own it and put the, you know, the proceeds into their own rollover account or whatever, however they would have taken custody of those funds and whatever tax options, which is the part B, the tax consequences of all of this, since it's a qualified account. But this part, what I'm talking about, would be applicable to qualified or just cash, right? If it's a bank account, the same thing would happen. So
this situation was even more complex because they had already gone through the months and months long process of settling the estate. It got all wrapped up and closed, and then right afterwards, hey, guess what? We found this account.
Yeah, so you can reopen a probate. So okay. It would still be paid to the probate, but you'd have to reopen it, which is just another way to process it. It does happen with later found assets, though there are provisions under Oregon law. You don't have to rinse and repeat the whole probate process, but you do have to administer and open a new, you know, do a filing fee and process that. So additional costs on the legal side. But you can, whether the estate is open or closed, I mean, it's a pain, but you can reopen the estate. But the estate would be entitled to those funds. If the beneficiary died first, before the owner, then this is the importance of having a contingent beneficiary, right? It would roll over to the next. And if there wasn't a beneficiary named, and it's funny when my clients just look at me and say, well, that'll never happen. My kids would never die before me.
Right.
My spouse will definitely never die before me. She's healthy as a horse, and here I am, right? And there's always this what if. It's really important to have depth to your plan, whether that's in a trust or a will or a beneficiary designation. So have a contingent. It can be a charity of your choice. It doesn't have to be, you know, really detailed, or it doesn't have to be your great aunt. You don't have to go for a big stretch, but just think about what that depth would be so that you don't end up without a beneficiary. But that's what's in your control. What's not in your control is a situation you're describing where your beneficiary survived you, but here we go.
2 months later, just...
Oh, just, that's so sad.
That happens more often than I think you'd think, right? I mean, husband and wife have been married, or...
They've been together a long time.
50-something years. You know, you've been married a long time. Oftentimes, the spouse, and I shouldn't specify husband and wife, but spouses, right, have been together for a long period of time. Often enough, the surviving spouse will pass away not too long after that, right? I mean, that probably happens more often than we think. So if you have the contingent beneficiary, it doesn't really help. And I mean, it does eventually, but it doesn't help in the way that if your beneficiary had predeceased you, right?
Right.
Just for my own learning purposes, let's say the first person that owned that SEP IRA had named contingents, passed away, and then the primary person, the beneficiary, passed away, would it then flow to the contingents? Or
so the legal answer would be no, it still goes to that. But let's say you name your spouse and then your kids, and the spouse's estate goes to the kids. So can't you just jump the estate and get the better tax treatment? So the legal answer is no.
No, you can't.
You can't.
Oh, shucks.
But will the financial institution, will a CPA work through, you know, try to make that argument? Try to say that maybe legally the will says that you have to survive by 90 days or Oregon law says, can you make that leap? Can you make that articulate? Well, are you going to get audited and then potentially pay? So there's a risk here of not just doing the straight up legal way, but I'm not going to say that people haven't done it.
Gotcha. I, you know, that's a good way of answering.
It's a wonderful interpretation. The law is
I would never recommend that somebody do it that way.
Right.
I would never rubber stamp with my license that this is how it should be done. But I do know that things happen, and there are times where I walk away going, really?
Sure.
They distributed that account to the okay.
To those people,
well,
yeah.
You know, here's my CYA letter on why I didn't say that you should do this, and I don't want this to come back and bite you. But in the meantime, if that's ultimately where it should go, and everybody's and you've got a CPA who's going to back it, or the financial institution is going to release it, and that's really the way the morally right way it should happen, then who am I to go and try to undo that action and add all these costs? So that's my philosophy on it. But legally speaking, it's pretty black and white.
So from an estate perspective, we definitely want to make sure that name primary beneficiaries, have a backup for the contingents. Is it smart also to have a will or perhaps a trust?
Absolutely, because let's say that you were to die without a beneficiary, you didn't want to have someone else, then it's likely to go to your estate. And that's where you need to have a will or a trust to say how you want those funds to be distributed and whether you can use the, if you had, say, a trust for your kids set up, and that could be adult kids for all sorts of reasons, right? Yeah. It doesn't have to be that you have little kids, but if you have some protections in place and you want to try to have that be a pass-through entity, or there's a lot of complications that come up with it. So the long and short of it is, yes, absolutely, you should be considering how your accounts that pass by beneficiary designation coordinate with your estate plan, have an estate plan that supports it, because it may put more tools in your toolbox for how to not get hit with, especially, well, there's a lot of reasons, but also not get hit with the really negative tax consequences, which is that part B when the first thing you said, this is a qualified account. So what is that? I mean, why don't you explain real quick what a qualified account is, and then I can go into the...
Sure. Yeah. Well, so, you know, when people hear the qualified account, that just means that, you know, it's a tax deferred account. It qualified technically applies to any, you know, employer sponsored plan, whether that's a SEP IRA, a simple IRA, or the 401k or 403b plan. When we're talking qualified accounts, generally speaking, when we're using that colloquial term qualified, we're talking about tax deferred accounts, uh-huh. right? So stuff that is applied. And that's IRAs, Roth IRAs, you know, that's any of those accounts that fall under the new SECURE Act, which we've talked about ad nauseum, right, about the new distribution rules, right?
Right.
So when you have that tax consequence of now leaving that to the estate and it has to be distributed, you pay taxes dollar for dollar on the money you take out.
Right. That does leave me taking away some key thoughts in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I get it when I sit down with perhaps a new client or somebody that I've only been working with for maybe a year or two, and you kind of get the sense that there's just more out there. And it's not like I am sitting across the table saying, hey, give me all of your assets. But it is nice to be at least in the know, at least to be able to play quarterback. So we know all the pieces of assets and all the accounts out there. So there's nothing that just gets left like this and becomes a real tax problem and a state problem.
Right, exactly. And it's amazing how many people don't really think through what they have. And one of the best things that I think financial advisors can do is to sit down and say, now, okay, this is what you have with me. Great. Now tell me about everything else you have too. I want to know what you have with your employer. What about your former employers? Because that type of information gathering to get the complete financial picture is really, really important. And when I can have all of that information in front of me as an estate planner, it makes my job that much more efficient to say, okay, your financial advisor can help you coordinate this stuff. If this is the game plan, how do we execute? And it's really hard when you have 10, 12, 15 different financial institutions involved, because you have where you bank, you have where you have your savings, you have that little investment account on the side, you have your former one that you rolled over here, and you've got this one here, and it adds up, and it can
and
be really
all
tough.
The people of the estate, either the named beneficiaries or the estate, they have to go to all of those institutions and relive that painful experience one after another. I had a client that had 11 different places that she had her money at, and it wasn't like it was all written out on paper. It was like an Easter egg hunt. They had to find different things. And it's like, oh, they got a statement in the mail, you know, 3 months later, right. Oh, she must have money there. Let's go continue that journey. It took 18 months just to find everything.
Right. And when people ask me, well, how long is probate going to take? I say, well, there's the court part, but then there's all the information gathering. And that's the same whether you have a probate or a trust administration. So what are the two simplest things that you can do to save cost? One is be organized, work with a financial advisor so that they can help you stay on top of things as you move things around and consolidate. And the other is, how much are people going to fight about it? Right. And those are just, if you're organized, then you could skip a lot of those 18-month endeavors. I love how you call it Easter egg hunt. It does feel like that. What's inside this one? I don't know. It could be $1,000. It could be $1 million. It could be anything in between.
Right. Well, that makes a big difference. So I wanted to ask you, we had a situation where a client, his spouse passed away. They'd been together, and they're, you know, domestic partners rather than married, but same deal, right? Say all the same legal, you know, effects as being married, but his spouse passed away. And now he was asking, he said, you know, well, that was my beneficiary, right? So who do I name now? Like, do I need to name somebody else? Do I need to, you know, do I need to update my will? And I said,
Right.
You know, if that's your only, because they don't have kids, they didn't have any, you know, necessarily a charity they wanted to leave stuff to. He did have his brother and then another friend that's going to help him, you know, now that you've lost your spouse of 50 something years, right? Just kind of maneuver through things, but you want to make sure, right? Because his question was, well, what happens? I said, well, you know, they have to go through the whole probate process. It's going to go to the state, right? The state's going to now decide.
Well, it'll go to the heirs at law. So it'll go through who's your nearest living relative. That may or may not be who you want it to be.
Right.
So if it is a distant second cousin, and that's the nearest relative, then there you go. If they can't find anybody, then it ends up going basically to the Department of Lands. But it takes a while to get there. And then the other question is, but who's going to be motivated to do that? Right. Who's going to go through the, you know, private investigator to say that? So it ends up being really difficult in a number of levels. And the long and short of it is, pick somebody, pick anybody. It can be a placeholder till you change your mind. And you can establish some really interesting. One of my favorite tools is a donor advised fund with the Oregon Community Foundation. So you can basically name this donor advised fund as the beneficiary. And then all you have to do is change your statement of intent with the Oregon Community Foundation. No charge, no attorney's fees, no complication. You want it to go to animal rescues? Okay, they can find animal rescues that are aligned with your intent. You want it to go to the Humane Society? Okay, well then they can filter through, and they basically act as the go-between, and then you can change your mind easily. Right. So there's a lot of ways that you can.
I think you were looking at me because you knew I donate to Cat Adoption.
I
volunteer there every other Saturday and stuff.
That's a quality
establishment.
If people are looking for places to donate to,
just throwing some ideas out there.
I actually got all of my cats from Cat Adoption Team. They are a great organization. But the nice thing about also using a donor advice fund like that is, well, what if Cat Adoption Team gets acquired by a larger,
right?
You know, what if the entity changes or morphs in some way? You're basically covered because it's a larger beneficiary, and you also get the charitable deduction. So,
and you can change that easily.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Very nice.
Oregon Community Foundation is, in my experience, been really good to work with. And it's the only place in Oregon I'm aware of that you can have that type of flexibility as easily. That's with a big, there's a lot of nonprofits that you can go directly to. But those are all the things that you can think through and that we would be talking about for your catch-all beneficiary, so to speak, as part of your estate plan, but then updating your retirement accounts. And on the tax hit of the question that you brought up, the estate is the beneficiary here. The hard thing that's hard to stomach, and the reason why you might want to wiggle out some gray areas, is that even with the passage of the SECURE Act, which Bo and I have talked about quite a bit, so we don't have to go into detail there, but basically an estate is going to have to pay the tax on that, and it needs to be distributed out within 5 years. But usually there's no huge benefit to waiting 5 years. Most people, in my experience, choose to just take the hit, distribute it out in, you know, that first year, at least have the cash, but now you're paying, you know, more than half in taxes. So it's a really hard number to stomach when you look at that. And Ouch. If you were to name an individual, you have more flexibility to figure out what that looks like. There are special types of trust, but after secure, it's even more complicated. So the long and short of it is name a beneficiary, talk to your professionals, have depth, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, however many beneficiaries you want, to make sure that you're covered and you don't find yourself within the things that you can control.
So if that estate wanted a 5-year hold time to distribute the assets, it has to be held in the name of the estate? Those funds have to go in the name of the estate?
So sometimes, yes, that's my understanding, that they, unless they can be distributed out, right, then it's, but you have to close out that account to get it to the estate heirs, and that has to be approved by the court, any estate distribution, unless you have a partial distribution for a specific asset. It can get a little bit more specific, but the general rule is, yes, the estate has to stay open. And so long as an estate stays open, you have to do at least an annual accounting of everything that's gone in, everything that's gone out. Just more fees, more filing fees, more attorney's fees, yeah.
more
time,
headache.
More headache. And the longer you're open, the more more vulnerable is the right word, you are to creditors.
I was going to ask that. If creditors come out of the woodwork, oh, we missed our deadline. Now that keeps that door open, right?
It is. So it's an interesting thing. So there's a 4-month creditor period with an estate. Well, that 4-month period, when that's over, it doesn't really mean that the door is shut. It means that you can now close the estate. And then if the estate is closed and the creditors come forward, now the door is shut. You have to prove to, you know, they could reopen it under very limited circumstances. I was a known creditor. You knew about me and you didn't give me notice and you shut the door anyway. That's not okay. That was the wrong thing to do. Here's all the proof I have. But if it's an unknown creditor that you didn't have any awareness of, but or maybe you had some limited, they can still file a claim and you'd still have to refute it and you'd still have to come back. And it's something that is more cost and an uphill battle.
That's what I'm hearing, all those things. More cost.
More cost.
More cost.
More
right?
pain.
More cost than you should have to
Who
pay.
Who needs more headaches this year?
Right.
Yeah, right. 2020 right. could end. So, you know, that I think that's a good place for us to take a break right here. I really appreciate you joining us, Taylor. I know that you are super busy, so I know taking some time out, it's really great for Matt. I'm really excited. This is Matt's now third week on the radio.
So number three.
We are picking up some steam, and it's really a lot more fun. I know the last couple of weeks, you know, we did this by, you know, via phone, so it's a lot more fun to be sitting around and doing this. So if you have a question
Your baby was quite animated. She's going to be a rock star also, following in mom's shoes.
Right, Maya had a lot of words to say about the conversation. But if you have a question for Taylor, folks, if you have something that has been keeping you up at night and you'd like to have answered, we have gotten a couple via email. We're going to try to answer over the next couple of weeks and see if she can't provide her insight. She can't give you specific legal advice, right? But we can talk in generalities about different ways to explore it. But Taylor, if people want to get a hold of you, if they want to come see you, and we are now in our Bethany office right now out here, yep. where mm-hmm. Taylor and her team can meet with you, how do they get a hold of you?
Best way is to call our office, 503-878-8948, or shoot us an email. You can find our contact at kglawgroup.com.
Perfect. If you have another question that's been keeping you up at night, you can send it into askbo@pfgwm.com. You can also send a request to get Taylor's contact info. I am happy to give that out to you. So stay tuned with us. We're going to come back and talk some investing ideas. We're going to talk about some questions that have come in from listeners. But if you do have a question, drop it to askbo@pfgwm.com. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help.
If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
And welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thank you for joining us. If you're just now tuning in, we spent some time talking through some stock split questions. We've had some questions come in from listeners, and I think it's thrilling when we have Taylor come in and sit down and talk about legal issues. I know a lot of people can get, you know, sort of bored about it, but, you know, so we're going to maybe change gears up a little bit here from the legal beagle stuff, you know, the cover your assets, which I still think is just a funny segment, but just a name for a segment, which is hilarious. But we're going to talk a little bit, Matt, about there's a debate out there, and you'll hear, you know, we talked about legendary value investor Warren Buffett, right, and how he invests in stocks. And a lot of times people have a question about what is better, you know, out there when they're talking about active versus passive investing. And maybe if you wouldn't mind start, just kind of give a brief, you know, overview for people who don't know, what's the difference between active or passive investing?
I would say I would start with the passive side of that question. So a passive investment is normally an index fund. And when you're passively investing, you're basically just buying that index fund. Some of the characteristics are usually in this day and age, they're incredibly inexpensive to own.
The word I'd use is cheap, right? It's just super cheap.
Super cheap.
Costs you almost nothing.
Share price, that's relative to the index that you're owning, but on a internal expense perspective, an index fund is generally rock bottom pricing. Like generally what we'd see on a S&P 500 index fund is maybe a 0.05% internal expense.
So when you're looking at your investments, when you're thinking about them, you can basically follow what the S&P 500 returned on that day and minus that 0.05%, you know, that cost of 0.05%. So if the S&P does 10% this year, you'll get 9.95% return, basically.
Right? Hopefully so. There is something called tracking error when you're owning index funds, and it's, you know, you would think, it's just an S&P 500 index fund. Why should I go with company A over company B? Well, if company A has a slightly better tracking error, meaning not as bad with their error, it closely mirrors the market better. So that tracking error can lead to maybe just a slight bit more return or less losses.
Sure, that makes sense. And so that's kind of the situation when people say the traditional 60-40 portfolio, right? I'm gonna build a 60-40 portfolio, and that generally speaking, they're talking about index funds, yeah?
60% stocks, 40% bonds in tracking indexes, yes.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned earlier, the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, he does say that you should just, the average investor should just buy an S&P 500 index fund and own it for the rest of their lives.
Susie Orman says the same thing, I'm pretty sure. That's, you know, that's been her spiel for a long time.
It's an option, certainly an option. But when we're talking about index funds, that's generally the first detail that most people go to, is that they're incredibly inexpensive. The internal expenses are low. So compare that to active funds or actively managed funds. That means you have a fund manager and a fund team of analysts, usually certified financial analysts and their understudies that are working on that team to try to not only match that index, but beat that index over a period of time. Sure. Generally, they want a little bit longer, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of leeway to do that, because in any given year, some teams can have a, you know, a decent year or a bad year.
Right.
I would point to my favorite actively managed fund last year, Bo, you know this one.
I do.
The Morgan Stanley Growth Fund. It had a really stellar decade prior to about July of last year. And when I say stellar, it was at one period of time, looking back 10 years, it was top 1% in the 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year periods. Just one, straight across the board.
It's basically number one, or not necessarily number one.
Top 1%.
Top 1% of all the, and for folks that don't know, there are thousands upon thousands of mutual funds out there. So when we're talking about top 1%, that's a pretty high it comes with some pretty high cachet.
Right, right. And that's in the large growth index.
Sure.
So it was doing quite well for a long period of time. And then late July, they ran into a little trouble. The wheels started coming off. August, September, October, that thing was like all of a sudden just swan dives when the rest of the market, if you remember the back half of last year was really solid.
Yeah.
And this particular index fund did not track very well to the overall market. It ended up being about 12% behind, if memory serves correct, last year. 12%
is a lot.
Is a bit when the market's up 30 and you're only up 18-ish, something like that. That's a margin of error that's, you know, hard to justify. But then this year, it's destroyed the index. It came back and with gangbusters and just really has outperformed the large growth index and then some. So back into that all-star class
range
performance.
So what I'm hearing and my takeaway from that is if you're looking for that actively managed portfolio, which, and we're not casting aspersions either way, we're trying to talk, bring you information and what we see out there. But if you're looking for that actively managed portfolio, when you're analyzing these actively managed funds, that short time period may not be the best and most accurate way of looking at it. Like a lot of people will say, what's it done so far this year? What's it done year to date? What's it done over the last year? We like to look at more of a longer term. We want to see that's important to see what it's done in the short term. But we want to know what it's done in the long term and what the plans are from that management team on the way going forward, right? I mean, we want to know what's the plan to outperform the index? Because again, why are you paying that extra cost if they're not doing so?
Exactly. And one of the characteristics of an actively managed fund is generally much higher expenses. So there are certain funds that are more expensive than others and their track records can justify it. And sometimes they're just more expensive because they're more expensive.
Yep.
So cost is certainly an issue. When we're looking at what's better, passive or active, it really depends on what market environment we're in. In a straight upward moving market, index funds are tough to beat. And sure. Over the last 5 years or more, as fee compression or the lowering of internal expenses to near zero has become more prominent, it's a race to the bottom on cost. There have been so many outflows of dollars away from actively managed funds to the index funds.
Sure.
Vanguard being the big push.
Yeah, they're the big hog molly on the street, right?
Right, right. And John Bogle, legendary mind over the last decade, he has done incredibly well. He's no longer with us.
I think
us,
he passed away, yeah.
Done just phenomenal things for the investment world to bring costs down. But at the end of the day, if we can get some, maybe a blend of active and passive inside a portfolio, you just never know what environment you're going to be in an investment world. So again, active and passive investments do better depending on what environment they're in.
Right. And, you know, we always talk about, we're trying to build all weather portfolios for our clients and not necessarily just look to, you know, spectacularly outperform or under, you know, we want to make sure you have a portfolio that fits with your plan. And that's what we build. We start with that financial plan and build it out with, you know, in those efficient markets, we'll use some of those passively traded funds, the passively managed funds. We want to keep costs down, but it's about what kind of roller coaster folks want to ride, right? I mean, if they were in, so if someone said, well, yeah, why don't I just buy, you know, QQQ, right? It's the ETF that tracks the NASDAQ, right? So they want to, but
super
then
tech heavy.
Super tech heavy, which
sounds like a great idea.
Went straight down in March and then straight up. And then over the last couple of weeks has been straight down again, where you could, you know, if you can ride that roller coaster. That's the issue with, for me personally, is at least what I've seen, Matt, in terms of the folks that say I'm 60-40 portfolio. And that's fine if you're going to just set and forget and hold for the long term. But I think, you know, Vanguard itself, talking to Jack Bogle and, you know, what they put out, they have a white paper that we have used often and read where it says having an advisor, it's called Advisor Alpha, right? So it's having an advisor can add 300 basis points or 3% of excess return to your portfolio. And that doesn't necessarily mean specific security selection like we're talking about, but it's helping you build that all-weather portfolio, helping you have a plan so you can stick with that plan. Because when you're looking at your plan, and if your plan says we need to get you know, 6% a year in terms of returns, I don't care what the market's doing, right? Because is my plan on track, right? Now, if your plan requires a lot higher risk, or if you just happen to be someone who wants that higher risk, then yeah, we're looking for those outsized returns. When the market's doing 30, we don't want to be getting 18. But if the market did 30 and we got 18, I'm concerned about what does my plan look like, right? Am I taking too much risk? So, you know, the big thing is, if you're analyzing whether active or passive, our philosophy is there's a place for everything in your portfolio, and maybe not in your portfolio, but there's a place for everything in portfolios. And having a blend of active and passive strategies can really get you to where you're trying to go while minimizing risk. But the hard part is building that portfolio, right? So if you have been thinking about that, and if you haven't had a chance to have that portfolio reviewed in a while, give our office a call, 503-253-3000. We'd be happy to do an analysis. And like Matt and I have talked, you know, over and over, it starts with that plan. So we'll do that financial plan for you and figure out, okay, on an outlook on your plan, what's the best all-weather portfolio that's going to get you the best returns with the minimizing risk, right? And we're going to use a blend of those active and passive strategies that we think are working best for our clients. And we're trying to be nimble and trying to be making sure that we are putting that best product forward. So again, there's no obligation. If you sit down with our team, sit down and have that analysis done, it's totally free. There's no obligation. We like to provide that as a service to our radio listeners. So if you'd like to sit down, we have an office in Tigard, in Beaverton, or in Clackamas or Vancouver to meet with you if you'd like to sit down, or we can do that virtually as well. So we'll be right back with more Investing Simplified. Stick with us.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
And welcome back to Investing Simplified. You know, as we close out this show, Matt, we had a question that came in off the text line here on InvestingSimplifiedRadio.com. And I got to say, folks, I really appreciate the questions that come in, because Matt and I could sit here and just talk for days about, you know, the things that excite us. But
it's so quick. How that time just flies by. Yeah. I want to give out so much knowledge, but the clock just spins.
Don't worry. You got lots of time. We got lots. Every week, we're here every week with the folks, you know, checking in with you. But so the question that came in from the text line from our listener was about RMDs, because I know this has come up a lot with the CARES Act that started with coronavirus, and how they are waiving the requirement for RMDs this year. And Gail in Tigard asks, if we don't take the RMDs in 2020, does that mean we have to take two in 2021? Also, what happens with the Oregon state tax? Will we be penalized by the state for not taking our RMDs? So the answer that, you know, we are giving, and that understanding that we have, with the caveat always in there that Matt and I are not tax professionals, right? We would refer you to make sure you qualify everything we have with a CPA, and I'm hopeful that we can coordinate getting Kevin Stege back on the show here soon. He's hard to pin down. You know, this COVID pandemic has made him go a little crazy on wanting to get out and do things, I think, on the weekends. So we haven't been able to get him in. How dare he, right, now that he's free to get out. But the RMD is just waived for 2020. So basically, the way that the CARES Act is doing it, and this is my understanding, Matt, is that they've just said, hey, you don't have to take it for this year. That it just is a non-entity. It's as if it wasn't required this year. That's just basically the gist of it.
That's my understanding as well. And just to back it up to the beginning, RMDs, required minimum distributions. So the rule changed at the beginning of the year to age 72.
Right.
It used to be the year you turned 70 and a half, they started. Now it's 72.
Which is super confusing.
Right. And it's like, okay, how that delays
anybody
it
born in like July or August are very confused, you know?
Very confusing. It's like, August 1st?
Yeah, it's tough.
But so for 2020, no required minimum distributions. And that's not just for IRAs, but also for beneficiary IRAs as well.
Right. If you inherited it before January 1st, 2020, because the rule in the CARES Act, if you recall,
and I've talked about
this, you know, on the show before, if you inherited an IRA this year, if you're unfortunately your loved one or your close friend or whoever left you the IRA passed away in 2020, that means that now you have fallen under the new rule of inherited IRAs where there are no RMDs. You just have 10 years to take all your money out.
Correct. So but these would be people coming from prior to 2020 that have RMDs in those beneficiary
that were trying, they were having to take them out. Yeah. And they're just waving it off. And so that applies both federally and to the state of Oregon because the RMD is a requirement from the feds. It's not a state requirement. But being here in Oregon, the people over, you know, across the river in Vancouver are just laughing at us, right? But being here in Oregon,
it's worth the 9+%, right?
Yeah, right. Being here in Oregon, the requirement for that required minimum distribution doesn't come from the state. It just comes from the federal level. You just have to pay taxes on it in the state because we're pulling the money out, right? So,
right.
Which is why a lot of people move to Vancouver and still be in this Portland area. And I'm not selling, you know, I'm moving from Portland. We both live here in town and the plan is to live here in Oregon, right?
We did have an estate attorney friend that actively would move people down to Arizona just because Oregon's higher estate tax.
Yeah.
The people's were relatively low estate tax.
He called it the People's Republic of Oregon, right? That was his terminology for Oregon. But so, you know, when you're talking about required minimum distributions, you don't have, it is waived for this year. And that kind of dovetails into, I just want to touch briefly on the stimulus. And if we get more stimulus coming out, you know, in the coming weeks, which may happen or may not, but that stimulus that came out at the beginning of the year is not taxable income. It's actually a tax credit that they created for this year, and they're just prepaying you for it. So it's not taxable income. You're not going to have to pay it back or pay, you know, state income tax or anything on that. It's a credit on that. It's my understanding. But Matt, we were talking as we were reading this question about, and I've talked about it before, but some interesting ways to get around having to pay that tax on that RMD if 2020 notwithstanding. But once we get out of this, you know, vicious scape that is 2020, but into 2021 and beyond, if you have an RMD, but maybe you don't need the funds and you really don't want to pay the taxes on it, you know, one of the things that we've done has been a qualified charitable distribution, right?
Correct. So it could be any charity that you would like to donate money to, and you plain and simply get a little bit of information from that charitable organization, and very quickly and easily, usually within 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, your required minimum distribution can be sent to that charitable organization. And now you've satisfied your required minimum distribution, check that box, and you don't have to pay taxes on it.
And, you know, interestingly enough, and we learned this because Kevin is a big, big proponent of the qualified charitable distribution, as I think all CPA should be, because they're trying to save their clients money on taxes, right? But normally, if you get an RMD or you take a withdrawal from your retirement account, it comes to you, and then you would have to donate some of that money to charity. But if you're charitably inclined, why not combine the two and let's cut the middleman out, and you don't get that 1099-R. You don't have to report on the taxes. Hey, your RMD is satisfied, but it went straight to the charity. The charity doesn't have to pay any taxes on it. You get the tax deduction based on the fact that you didn't have to pay taxes on it. Now, because people will say, well, I want the deduction. I would argue that, no, you don't want the income and then the deduction. How about we just don't have the income at all, right? You can still donate more money to the charity and get the deduction on the other side.
So this next part, I'd really like to have Kevin sitting here to kind of talk through that. But one of the other things you can do for future years, if you convert your traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, then the money in the Roth no longer has a required minimum distribution.
Right.
Yes, you have to pay taxes on the year you convert it. Yep. And that each conversion, if you do multiple, each conversion will have its own 5-year clock that starts ticking that year that you made the conversion before you can pull it out tax-free. But
well, it depends on your age. But yeah, we did that with Kevin.
Oh,
we
had that whole issue. To have him here. So that is a great way to maybe for future years pay less and less taxes because you've shifted that those dollars over to the Roth that don't have the RMDs.
Yeah. No, like you said, that's a great way to get prepared, and folks are probably rolling their eyes now because they've heard me talk Roth conversions so much. And as we kind of come
up... Here's the plain and simple point that I try to pass across to my clients. We're at, historically, on the very, very low side for taxes. We have a 12% tax bracket, and then it jumps to 22 and 24. And you got to make pretty good money before you're in the 22 and 24% tax bracket. In 1974, if you made $75,000 joint, granted, that would buy a whole lot more than it would today. But $75,000 in 1974, you were at a 54% federal tax rate.
Right.
So today, you're at 12.
So it's now a good time to maybe convert your assets, you know, to look at doing Roth conversions. And
you've got a approaching $27 trillion national debt.
Right. Which is...
Perhaps maybe we would need to
raise taxes
or cut benefits. I mean, you don't want to get down the rabbit hole there, but that's a bill that's going to have to be paid at some point, and generally not with historically low taxes. Not that I'm a proponent of higher taxes, but... Get real. This is kind of my thing.
That's what it's going to come out. And that's, you know, I hate to cut the conversation off there, but maybe next week as we launch, you know, Matt's going to have his segment, and we're spitballing. I think
I'd like it to be my catchphrase.
Get real. Get real with Matt May. So make sure you know, if you have questions, tune it in, and we'll get out of here with that. But if you have questions and want to see about doing a Roth conversion, and you want to come in and see our team and see if that makes sense for you, give us a call, 503-253-3000. Tune in next week for another episode of Investing Simplified. Thank you for being with us. God bless y'all, and stay safe out there.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified at pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000, or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. We'll be right back.